it had outside the Desert Rose.
Bevy from the levee had said that in Derry I think the bad times are over. I wasn't convinced about Derry, and I felt the same way about Dallas, even with its worst days still over 3 years away.
"I'll commute," I said. "George wants a nice quiet place to work on his book. But since the book is about a city, a haunted city, he really has to commute, doesn't he, to get material." It was no wonder it took me almost 2 months to think of this. Life's simplest answers are often the easiest to overlook. I went back to bed and fell asleep almost at once. That next day I drove south, out of Dallas, on Highway 77. An hour and a half took me into Denholm County. I turned west onto State Road 109, mostly because I liked the billboard marking the intersection. It showcased a heroic young football player wearing a gold helmet, black jersey, and gold leggings. "Denholm Lions," the billboard proclaimed, "three-time district champs, state championship bound in 1960. We've got gym power." Whatever that is, I thought. But of course, every high school has its secret signs and signals. It's what makes kids feel like they're on the inside. 5 miles up Highway 109, I came to the town of Jody. Population 1,280, the sign said. "Welcome, stranger." Halfway up the wide, tree-lined main street, I saw a little restaurant with a sign in the window reading, "Best shakes, fries, and burgers in all of Texas." It was called Al's Diner. Of course it was. I parked in one of the slant spaces out front, went in, and ordered the pronghorn special, which turned out to be a double cheeseburger with barbecue sauce. It came with mesquite fries and a rodeo thick shake, your choice of vanilla, chocolate, or strawberry. A pronghorn wasn't quite as good as a fat burger, but it wasn't bad. And the fries were just the way I liked them, crispy, salty, and a little overdone. Al turned out to be Al Stevens, a skinny, middle-aged guy who looked nothing like Al Templeton. He had a rockabilly hairdo, a gray-streaked bandito mustache, a thick Texas drawl, and a paper hat worn jauntily cocked over one eye. When I asked him if there was much to rent in the town of Jody, he laughed and said, "Take your pick. But when it comes to jobs, this ain't exactly a center of commerce. Ranch land, mostly, and you'll pardon me saying, but you don't look like the cowboy type." "I'm not," I said. "Actually, I'm more the book-writing type." "Get out! Anything I might have read?" "Not yet," I said. "I'm still trying. I've got about half a novel written, and a couple of publishers have shown some interest. I'm looking for a quiet place to finish." "Well, Jody's quiet, all right." Al rolled his eyes. "When it comes to quiet, I reckon we could take out a patent. Only gets noisy on Friday nights."
"Football?"
"Yes, sir. Whole town goes. Halftime comes, they all roar like lions, then give out the gym yell. You can hear 'em 2 miles away. It's pretty comical."
"Who's Jim?"
"Ledoux, the quarterback. We've had us some good teams, but ain't never been a QB like Ledoux on a Denholm team. And he's only a junior. People been talking about the state championship. That seems a tad optimistic to me, with those big Dallas schools just up the road. But a little hope never hurt anybody. That's what I reckon."
"Football aside, how's the school?"
"It's real fine. A lot of people were doubtful about this consolidation thing at first. I was one of them. But it's turned out to be a good thing. They got over 700 this year. Some of them bus in an hour or more. But they don't seem to mind. Probably saves them chores at home."
"Is your book about high school kids, Blackboard Jungle kind of thing?"
"Because there ain't no gangs or anything out here. Out here, kids still mind their manners."
"Nothing like that. I've got savings, but I wouldn't mind stretching what I've got with some substitute work. I can't teach full-time and still write."
"Course not," he said respectfully.
My degree's from Oklahoma, but I shrugged to show Oklahoma wasn't in Texas's league, but a man could hope. Well, you ought to talk to Dink Simmons. He's the principal. Comes in for dinner most evenings. His wife died a couple of years back. Sorry to hear that, I said. Oh, we all were. He's a nice man. Most people are in these parts, Mr. Amberson, George Amberson. Well, George, we're pretty sleepy, except on Friday nights. But you could do worse. Might could even learn to roar like a lion at halftime. Maybe I could, I said. You come on back around 6. That's usually the time Deke comes in. He put his arms on the counter and leaned over them. Want a tip? Sure. He'll probably have his lady friend with him, Miss Corcoran, the librarian up to the school. He's kind of been sparking her since last Christmas or so. I've heard that Mimi Corcoran's the one who really runs Denholm Consolidated because she runs him. If you impress her, I reckon you're in like Flynn. I'll keep that in mind, I said. Weeks of apartment hunting in Dallas had netted me exactly one possible, which turned out to be owned by a man I didn't want to rent from. It took me 3 hours in Jody to find a place that looked fine. Not an apartment, but a tidy little 5-room shotgun house. It was for sale, the real estate agent told me, but the couple who owned it would be willing to rent to the right party. There was an elm-shaded backyard, a garage for the Sunliner, and central air conditioning. The rent was reasonable, given the amenities. Freddie Quinlan was the agent's name. He was curious about me. I think the main license plate on my car struck him as exotic, but not unduly so. Best of all, I felt I was out from under the shadow that had lain over me in Dallas, Derry, and Sunset Point, where my last long-term rental now lay in ashes. "Well," Quinlan asked, "what do you think?" "I want it, but I can't give you a yes or no this afternoon. I have to see a fellow first. I don't suppose you'll be open tomorrow, will you?" "Yes, sir, I will. Saturdays I'm open until noon. Then I go home and watch the game of the week on TV. Looks like it could be a heck of a series this year." "Yes," I said, "it certainly does." Quinlan extended his hand. "It was nice meeting you, Mr. Amberson. I bet you'd like Jody. We're good people around here. Hope it works out for you." I shook with him. "So do I." Like the man said, a little hope never hurt anybody. That evening I returned to Al's diner and introduced myself to the principal of Denholm Consolidated and his librarian lady friend. They invited me to join them. Deke Simmons was tall, bald, and 60-ish. Mimi Corcoran was bespectacled and tanned. The blue eyes behind her bifocals were sharp, looking me up and down for clues. She walked with the aid of a cane, handling it with the careless, almost contemptuous dexterity of long use. Both of them, I was amused to see, were carrying Denholm pennants and wearing gold buttons that read, "We've got gym power." It was Friday night in Texas. Simmons asked me how I was liking Jody. A lot. How long I'd been in Dallas. Since August. And if I enjoyed high school football. Yes, indeed. The closest he got to anything substantive was asking me if I felt confident in my ability to make kids mind. Because, he said, a lot of substitutes had a problem with that. "These young teachers send them to us in the office like we didn't have anything better to do," he said, and then chomped his pronghorn burger. "Sauce, Deke," Mimi said, and he obediently wiped the corner of his mouth with a paper napkin from the dispenser. She, meanwhile, was continuing her inventory of me. Sport coat, tie, haircut, the shoes she'd taken a good look at as I crossed to her booth. "Do you have references, Mr. Amberson?" "Yes, ma'am. I did quite a bit of substitute teaching in Sarasota County." "And in Maine?" "Not so much there, although I taught for 3 years in Wisconsin on a regular basis before quitting to work full-time on my book, or as much full-time as my finances would allow. I did have a reference from St. Vincent's High School in Madison. It was a good reference. I had written it myself. Of course, if anyone checked back, I'd be hung. Deke Simmons wouldn't do it, but sharp-eyed Mimi with the leathery cowboy skin might. And what is your novel about? This might also hang me, but I decided to be honest. As honest as possible, anyway, given my peculiar circumstances. A series of murders and their effect on the community where they happen. Oh, my goodness, Deke said. She tapped his wrist. Hush! Go on, Mr. Amberson. My original setting was a fictional main city. I called it Dawson, but then I decided it might be more realistic if I set it in an actual city, a bigger one. I thought Tampa at first, but it was wrong somehow. She waved Tampa away. Too pastel, too many tourists. You were looking for something a little more insular, I suspect. A very sharp lady. She knew more about my book than I did. That's right. So I decided to try Dallas. I think it's the right place, but... But you wouldn't want to live there? Exactly. I see. She picked at her piece of deep-fried fish. Deke was looking at her with a mildly poleaxed expression. Whatever it was he wanted as he went cantering down the backstretch of life, she appeared to have it. Not so strange. Everybody loves somebody sometime, as Dean Martin would so wisely point out, but not for another few years. And when you're not writing, what do you like to read, Mr. Amberson? Oh, just about everything. Have you read The Catcher in the Rye? Uh-oh, I thought. Yes, ma'am. She looked impatient at this. Oh, call me Mimi. Even the kids call me Mimi, although I insist they put a Ms. with it for propriety's sake. What do you think of Mr. Salinger's Cri de Coeur? Lie or tell the truth? But it wasn't a serious question. This woman would read a lie the way I could read, well, an impeach Earl Warren billboard. I think it says a lot about how lousy the 50s were, and a lot about how good the 60s can be. If the Holden Caulfields of America don't lose their outrage, that is, and their courage. Mm-hmm. Picking plenty at her fish, but not eating any that I could see. No wonder she looked like you could staple a string to the back of her dress and fly her like a kite. Do you believe it should be in the school library? I sighed, thinking how much I would have enjoyed living and teaching part-time in the town of Jody, Texas. Actually, ma'am, Mimi, I do. Although I believe it should be checked out only to certain students and at the librarian's discretion. The librarians? Not the parents? No, ma'am, that's a slippery slope. Mimi Corcoran burst into a wide smile and turned to her beau. Deke, this fellow doesn't belong on the substitute list. He should be full-time. Mimi. I know no vacancy in the English department, but if he sticks around, maybe he can step in after that idiot Phil Bateman retires. Mimes, that is very indiscreet. Yes, she said, and actually dropped me a wink. Also very true. Send Deke your references from Florida, Mr. Amberson. They should do nicely. Better yet, bring them in yourself next week. The school year has started. No sense in losing time. Call me George, I said. Yes, indeed, she said. She pushed her plate away. Deke, this is terrible. Why do we eat here? Because I like the burgers and you like Al's strawberry shortcake. Oh, yes, she said, the strawberry shortcake. Bring it on. Mr. Amberson, can you stay for the football game? Not tonight, I said. I've got to get back to Dallas. Maybe next week's game, if you think you can use me? If Mamie likes you, I like you, Dick Simmons said. I can't guarantee you a day every week, but some weeks there'll be two or even three. It'll all average out. I'm sure it will. The substitute salary isn't much. I'm afraid... I know that, sir. I'm just looking for a way to supplement my income. That catcher book will never be in our library, Deke said with a regretful side glance at his pursed-lipped paramour. School board won't have it. Mimi knows that. Another big bite of his prong burger. Times change, Mimi Corcoran said, pointing first to the napkin dispenser and then to the side of his mouth. Deke, sauce. The following week I made a mistake. I should have known better. Making another major wager should have been the last thing on my mind after all that had happened to me. You'll say I should have been more on my guard. I did understand the risk, but I was worried about money. I had come to Texas with something less than $16,000. Some was the remainder of Al's stake money, but most of it was the result of two very large bets, one placed in Derry and one in Tampa. But staying at the Adolphus for 7 weeks or so had eaten up over $1,000. Getting settled in a new town would easily cost another $400 or $500. Food, rent, and utilities aside, I was going to need a lot more clothes, and better ones, if I was going to look respectable in a classroom. I'd be based in Jody for 2.5 years before I could conclude my business with Lee Harvey Oswald. $14,000 or so wasn't going to cut it. The substitute teaching salary? $15.50 a day. Yeehaw. Okay. Maybe I could have scraped through on $14,000, plus 30 and sometimes even $50 a week as a sub, but I'd have to stay healthy and not have any accidents, and I couldn't bank on that, because the past is sly as well as obdurate. It fights back. And yes, maybe there was an element of greed involved, too. If so, it was based less on the love of money than on the intoxicating knowledge that I could beat the usually unbeatable house, whenever I wanted to. I think now, if Al had researched the stock market as thoroughly as who won all those baseball games, football games, and horse races, but he didn't. I think now, if Freddie Quinlan hadn't mentioned that the World Series was shaping up to be a doozy, but he did. And I went back to Greenville Avenue. I told myself that all those straw-hatted punters I'd seen standing out in front of Faith Financial, where trust is our watchword, would be betting the series, and some of them would be laying down serious cash. I told myself that I'd be one among many, and a middling bet from Mr. George Amberson, who'd claimed to be living in a nice converted garage duplex on Blackwell Street, right here in Dallas, should anyone inquire, would attract no attention. Hell, I told myself the guys running Faith Financial probably don't know Señor Eduardo Gutierrez of Tampa from Adam, or from Noah's son Ham, for that matter. Oh, I told myself lots of things, and they all boiled down to the same two things, that it was perfectly safe and that it was perfectly reasonable to want more money, even though I currently had enough to live on. Dumb. But stupidity is one of two things we see most clearly in retrospect. The other is missed chances. On September 28th, a week before the series was scheduled to start, I walked into Faith Financial and, after some dancing, put down $600 on the Pittsburgh Pirates to beat the Yankees in 7. I accepted 2-to-1 odds, which was outrageous considering how heavily favored the Yankees were. On the day after Bill Mazeroski hit his unlikely ninth-inning home run to seal the deal for the Buccos, I drove back to Dallas and Greenville Avenue. I think that if Faith Financial had been deserted, I would have turned around and driven right back to Jody, or maybe that's just what I tell myself now. I don't know for sure. What I do know is there was a queue of bettors waiting to collect, and I joined it. That group was a Martin Luther King dream come true, 50% black, 50% white, 100% happy. Most guys came out with nothing but a few fives or maybe a double sawbuck or two, but I saw several who were counting C-notes. An armed robber who had chosen that day to hit Faith Financial would have done well indeed. The money man was a stocky fellow wearing a green eye shade. He asked me the standard first question. Are you a cop? If you are, you have to show me your ID. And when I answered in the negative, he asked for my name and a look at my driver's license. It was a brand new one which I had received by registered mail the week before. Finally, a piece of Texas identification to add to my collection, and I was careful to hold my thumb over the Jody address. He paid me my $1,200, I stuffed it in my pocket and walked quickly to my car. When I was back on Highway 77 with Dallas falling behind and Jody growing closer with every turn of the wheels, I finally relaxed. Stupid me. We're going to take another leap forward in time. Narratives also contain rabbit holes, when you stop to think of it. But I need to recount one more thing from 1960 first. Fort Worth, November 16th, 1960. Kennedy, the president-elect for a little over a week. The corner of Ballinger and West 7th. The day was cold and overcast. Cars puffed white exhaust. The weatherman on K-Life, all the hits, all the time, was forecasting rain that might thicken to sleet by midnight. So be careful on the highways, all you rockers and rollers. I was bundled into a rawhide ranch coat. A felt cap with flaps was jammed down over my ears. I was sitting on a bench in front of the Texas Cattle Raisers Association, looking down West 7th. I'd been there for almost an hour, and I didn't think the young man would visit with his mother much longer than that. According to Al Templeton's notes, all three of her boys had gotten away from her as soon as they possibly could. What I was hoping was that she might come out of her apartment building with him. She was recently back in the area after several months at Waco, where she had been working as a ladies' home companion. My patience was rewarded. The door of the Rotary Apartments opened, and a skinny man who bore an eerie resemblance to Lee Harvey Oswald came out. He held the door for a woman in a tartan car coat and blocky white nurse's shoes. She was only shoulder high to him, but solidly built. Her graying hair was scooped back from a prematurely lined face. She wore a red kerchief. Matching lipstick outlined a small mouth that looked dissatisfied and pugnacious, the mouth of a woman who believes the world is against her and has had plenty of evidence over the years to prove it. Lee Oswald's elder brother went quickly down the concrete path. The woman scurried after and grabbed the back of his top coat. He turned to her on the sidewalk. They appeared to argue, but the woman did most of the talking. She shook her finger in his face. No way I could tell what she was scolding him about. I was a prudent block and a half away. Then he started toward the corner of West 7th and Summit Avenue, as I had expected. He had come by bus, and that was where the nearest stop was. The woman stood where she was for a moment, as if undecided. "Come on, Mama," I thought. "You're not going to let him get away that easily, are you? He's just half a block down the street. Lee had to go all the way to Russia to get away from that wagging finger." She went after him, and as they neared the corner, she raised her voice, and I heard her clearly. "Stop! Robert, don't walk so fast! I'm not done with you!" He looked over his shoulder but kept walking. She caught up to him at the bus stop and tugged on his sleeve until he looked at her. The finger resumed its tick-tock wagging. I caught isolated phrases. "You promised!" And "gave you everything," and "I think." "Who are you to judge me?" I couldn't see Oswald's face because his back was to me, but his slumped shoulders said plenty. I doubted if this was the first time Mama had followed him down the street, jabbering away the whole time, oblivious of spectators. She spread a hand above the shelf of her bosom, that timeless mom gesture that says, "Behold me, ye thankless child." Oswald dug into his back pocket, produced his wallet, and gave her a bill. She stuffed it in her purse without looking at it and started back toward the Rotary Apartments. Then she thought of something else and turned to him once more. I heard her clearly, raised to shout across the 15 or 20 yards now between them. That reedy voice was like fingernails drawn down a slate blackboard. "And call me if you hear from Lee again. Hear? I'm still on the party line. It's all I can afford. until I get a better job, and that Sykes woman from downstairs is on it all the time. I spoke to her. I gave her a real piece of my mind. Mrs. Sykes, I said.
A man passed her. He stuck a theatrical finger in one ear, grinning. If Mama saw, she took no notice. She certainly took no notice of her son's grimace of embarrassment.
Mrs. Sykes, I said, you're not the only one who needs the phone, so I'd thank you to keep your calls short. And if you won't do it on your own, I may have to call a representative of the telephone company to make you do it. That's what I said. So you call me, Rob. You know I need to hear from Lee.
Here came the bus. As it pulled up, he raised his voice to be heard over the chuff of the air brakes.
He's a damn commie, Ma, and he's not coming home. Get used to it. You call me!
She shrilled. Her grim little face was set. She stood with her feet planted apart like a boxer, ready to absorb a blow. Any blow. Every blow.
Her eyes glared from behind black-rimmed harlequin glasses. Her kerchief was double-knotted beneath her chin.
The rain had begun to fall now, but she paid it no mind. She drew in breath and raised her voice to something just short of a scream.
I need to hear from my good boy! You hear?
Robert Oswald bolted up the steps and into the bus without replying. It pulled away in a chuff of blue exhaust, and as it did, a smile lit her face. It did something of which I would have thought a smile incapable. It made her simultaneously younger and uglier. A workman passed her. He didn't bump or even brush her as far as I could see, but she snapped,
"Watch where you're going! You don't own the sidewalk!"
Marguerite Oswald started back toward her apartment. When she turned away from me, she was still smiling. I drove back to Jody that afternoon, shaken and thoughtful. I wouldn't see Lee Oswald for another year and a half, and I remained determined to stop him, but I already felt more sympathy for him than I ever had for Frank Dunning. Chapter 13. It was 7:45 on the evening of May 18, 1961. The light of a long Texas dusk lay across my backyard. The window was open and the curtains fluttered in a mild breeze. On the radio, Troy Schondell was singing This Time. I was sitting in what had been the little house's second bedroom and was now my study. The desk was a cast-off from the high school. It had one short leg, which I had shimmed. The typewriter was a Webster portable. I was revising the first 150 or so pages of my novel, The Murder Place, mostly because Mimi Corcoran kept pestering me to read it, and Mimi, I had discovered, was the sort of person you could put off with excuses for only so long. The work was actually going well. I'd had no problem turning Derry into the fictional town of Dawson in my first draft, and turning Dawson into Dallas was even easier. I had started making the changes only so the work in progress would support my cover story when I finally let Mimi read it, but now the changes seemed both vital and inevitable. It seemed the book had wanted to be about Dallas all along. The doorbell rang. I put a paperweight on the manuscript pages so they wouldn't blow around and went to see who my visitor was. I remember all of this very clearly. The dancing curtains, the smooth Riverstone paperweight, This Time playing on the radio, the long light of Texas evening, which I had come to love. I should remember it. It was when I stopped living in the past and just started living. I opened the door and Michael Koslaw stood there. He was weeping.
"I can't, Mr. Amberson," he said. "I just can't."
"Well, come in, Mike," I said. "Let's talk about it." I wasn't surprised to see him. I had been in charge of Lisbon High's little drama department for 5 years before running away to the era of universal smoking, and I'd seen plenty of stage fright in those years. Directing teenage actors is like juggling jars of nitroglycerin, exhilarating and dangerous.
I've seen girls who were quick studies and beautifully natural in rehearsal freeze up completely on stage. I've seen nerdy little guys blossom and seem to grow a foot taller the first time they utter a line that gets a laugh from an audience. I've directed dedicated plodders and the occasional kid who showed a spark of talent, but I'd never had a kid like Mike Koslaw. I suspect there are high school and college faculty who've been working dramatics all their lives and never had a kid like him. Mimi Corcoran really did run Denholm Consolidated High School, and it was she who coaxed me into taking over the junior-senior play when Alfie Norton, the math teacher who'd been doing it for years, was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia and moved to Houston for treatments. I tried to refuse on the grounds that I was still doing research in Dallas, but I wasn't going there very much in the winter and early spring of 1961. Mimi knew it because whenever Deke needed an English sub during that half of the school year, I was usually available. When it came to Dallas, I was basically marking time. Lee was still in Minsk, soon to marry Marina Prusakova, the girl in the red dress and white shoes. "You've got plenty of time on your hands," Mimi had said. Her own hands were fisted on her non-existent hips. She was in full take-no-prisoners mode that day. "And it pays." "Oh, yeah," I said. "I checked that out with Deke. $50. I'll be living large in the hood." "In the what?" "Never mind, Mimi. For the time being, I'm doing all right for cash. Can't we leave it at that?" No, we couldn't. Miss Mimi was a human bulldozer, and when she met a seemingly immovable object, she just lowered her blade and revved her engine higher. Without me, she said, there would be no junior-senior play for the first time in the high school's history. The parents would be disappointed. The school board would be disappointed. "And," she added, drawing her brows together, "I will be bereft." "God forbid you should be bereft, Miss Mimi," I'd said. "Tell you what, if you let me pick the play, something not too controversial, I promise, I'll do it." Her frown had disappeared into the brilliant Mimi Corcoran smile that always turned Deke Simmons into a simmering bowl of oatmeal, which, temperamentally speaking, was not a huge transformation. "Excellent! Who knows, you may find a brilliant thespian lurking in our halls." "Yes," I said, "and pigs may whistle. But life is a joke. I had found a brilliant thesp. Unnatural. And now he sat in my living room on the night before our show opened for the first of four performances, taking up almost the entire couch, which bowed humbly beneath his 270 pounds, bawling his freaking head off. Mike Koslaw, also known as Lenny Small in George Amberson's OK for High School adaptation of John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. If, that was, I could talk him into showing up tomorrow. I thought about handing him some Kleenex and decided they weren't up to the job. I fetched a dish wiper from the kitchen drawer instead. He scrubbed his face with it, got himself under some kind of control, then looked at me desolately. His eyes were red and raw. He hadn't started crying as he approached my door. This looked like it had been going on all afternoon. "Okay, Mike, make me understand. Everybody on the team's making fun of me, Mr. Amberson. Coach started calling me Clark Gable. This was at the Lion Pride Spring Picnic, and now everybody's doing it. Even Jimmy's doing it." Meaning Jim Ledoux, the team's hot rod quarterback and Mike's best friend. I wasn't surprised about Coach Borman. He was a thud who preached the gospel of gung-ho and didn't like anyone poaching on his territory, either in season or out. And Mike had been called far worse. While hall monitoring, I'd heard him called Bohunk Mike, George of the Jungle, and Godzilla. He laughed the nicknames off. That amused, even absent-minded reaction to slurs and japes may be the greatest gift height and size conveys on large boys. And at 6'7 and 270, Mike made me look like Mickey Rooney. There was only one star on the Lions football team, and that was Jim Ledoux. Didn't he have his own billboard at the intersection of Highway 77 at Route 109? But if there was any player who made it possible for Jim to star, it was Mike Coslaw, who planned to sign with Texas A&M as soon as his senior high school season was over. Ledoux would be rolling with the Bama Crimson Tide, as both he and his father would be happy to tell you. But if someone had asked me to pick the one most likely to go pro, I would have put my money on Mike. I liked Jim, but to me, he looked like a knee injury or shoulder separation waiting to happen. Mike, on the other hand, seemed built for the long haul. What does Bobby Jill say? Mike and Bobby Jill Allnut were practically joined at the hip. Gorgeous girl? Check. Blonde? Check. Cheerleader? Why even ask? He grinned. Bobby Jill's behind me 1,000%. Says to man up and stop letting those other guys get my goat. Sounds like a sensible young lady. Yeah, she's the absolute best. Anyway, I suspect a little name-calling isn't what's really on your mind. And when he didn't reply, Mike, talk to me. I'm going to get up there in front of all those people and make a fool of myself. Jimmy told me so. Jimmy's a hell of a quarterback, and I know the two of you are pals. But when it comes to acting, he doesn't know jack shit. Mike blinked. In 1961, you usually didn't hear the word shit from teachers, even if they had a mouthful. But of course, I was only a substitute, and that freed me up some. I think you know that. As they say in these parts, you may stagger, but you ain't stupid. People think I am, he said in a low voice. And I'm strictly a C student. Maybe you don't know that. Maybe subs don't get to see the records, but I am. I made it a point to see yours after the second week of rehearsals. When I saw what you could do on stage, you're a C student because as a football player, you're supposed to be a C student. It's part of the ethos. The what? Figure it out from the context and save the dumb act for your friends. Not to mention Coach Borman, who probably has to tie a string on his whistle so he can remember which end to blow. Mike snickered at that, red eyes and all. Listen to me. People automatically think anyone as big as you is stupid. Tell me different if you want to. According to what I hear, you've been walking around in that body since you were 12, so you should know. He didn't tell me different. What he said was, everybody on the team tried out for Lenny. It was a joke, a goof, he added hastily. Nothing against you, Mr. A. Everybody on the team likes you. Even Coach likes you. A bunch of players had crashed the tryouts, intimidating the more scholarly aspirants into silence and all claiming they wanted to read for the part of George Milton's big, dumb friend. Of course it had been a joke, but Mike's reading of Lenny had been the farthest thing in the world from funny. What it had been was a goddamn revelation. I would have used an electric cattle prod to keep him in the room if that's what it took, but of course there was no need of such extreme measures. You want to know the best thing about teaching? Seeing that moment when a kid discovers his or her gift. There's no feeling on earth like it. Mike knew his teammates would make fun of him, but he took that part anyway. And of course Coach Borman didn't like it. The Coach Bormans of the world never do. In this case, however, there wasn't much he could do about it, especially with Mimi Corcoran on my side. He certainly couldn't claim he needed Mike for football practice in April and May, so he was reduced to calling his best lineman Clark Gable. There are guys who can't rid themselves of the idea that acting is for girls, and queers who sort of wish they were girls. Gavin Borman was that kind of guy. At Don Haggerty's annual April Fool's keg party, he'd whine to me about putting ideas in that big galoot's head. I told him he was certainly welcome to his opinion. Like assholes, everybody had one. Then I walked away, leaving him with a paper cup in his hand and a perplexed look on his face. The Coach Bormans of the world are also used to getting their way, through a kind of jocular intimidation, and he couldn't understand why it wasn't working on the lowly sub who'd stepped into Alfie Norton's director's shoes at the last minute. I could hardly tell Borman that shooting a guy to keep him from killing his wife and kids has a way of changing a man. Basically, Coach never had a chance. I cast some of the other football players as townspeople, but I meant to have Mike as Lenny from the moment he opened his mouth and said, "I remember about the rabbits, George." He became Lenny. He hijacked not just your eyes, because he was so damn big, but the heart and your chest. You forgot everything else, the way people forget their everyday cares when Jim Ledoux faded back to throw a pass. Mike might have been built to crash the opposing line in humble obscurity, but he had been made by God, if there is such a deity, by a roll of the genetic dice, if there is not, to stand on a stage and disappear into someone else. "It was a goof for everyone but you," I said.
"Oh, me too, at first."
"Because at first you didn't know."
"No, I didn't."
Husky, almost whispering, he lowered his head because the tears were coming again, and he didn't want me to see them. The coach had called him Clark Gable, and if I called the man on it, he'd claim it was just a joke, a goof, a yuck, as if he didn't know the rest of the squad would pick up on it and pile on. As if he didn't know that shit would hurt Mike in a way being called Bohunk Mike never could. Why do people do that to gifted people? Is it jealousy? Fear? Both, maybe. But this kid had the advantage of knowing how good he was. And we both knew Coach Borman wasn't really the problem. The only person who could stop Mike from going on stage tomorrow night was Mike. "You've played football in front of crowds 9 times bigger than the one that'll be in that auditorium. Hell, when you boys went down to Dallas for the regionals last November, you played in front of 10 or 12,000, and they were not friendly."
"Football's different. When we hit the field, we're all wearing the same uniform and helmets. Folks can only tell us apart by our numbers. Everybody's on the same side."
"There are 9 other people in this show with you, Mike. And that's not counting the townspeople I wrote in to give your football buddies something to do. They're a team, too."
"It's not the same."
"Maybe not quite. But one thing is the same. If you let them down, the shit falls apart and everybody loses. The actors, the crew, the pep club girls who did the publicity, and all the people who are planning to come in for the show, some of them from ranches 50 miles out. Not to mention me, I lose too."
"I guess that's so,"
he said. He was looking at his feet, and mighty big feet they were. "I could stand to lose Slim, or Curly. I'd just send someone out with the book to read the part. I guess I could even stand to lose Curly's wife.
I wish Sandy was a little better," Mike said. "She's pretty as hell, but if she ever hits her mark, it's an accident."
I allowed myself a cautious inward smile. I was starting to think this was going to be all right. What I couldn't stand, what the show couldn't stand, is to lose you or Vince Knowles. Vince was playing Lenny's road buddy, George, and actually, we could have stood the loss if he'd gotten the flu or broken his neck in a road accident, always a possibility given the way he drove his daddy's farm truck. I would have gone on in Vince's place if push came to shove, even though I was much too big for the part. And I wouldn't need just to read, either. After 6 weeks of rehearsals, I was as off the book as any of my actors, more than some. But I couldn't replace Mike. No one could replace him. With his unique combination of size and actual talent, he was the linchpin.
"What if I fuck up?"
he asked, then heard what he'd said and clapped a hand to his mouth. I sat down beside him on the couch. There wasn't much room, but I managed. Right then, I wasn't thinking of John Kennedy, Al Templeton, Frank Dunning, or the world I'd come from. Right then I was thinking of nothing but this big boy and my show. Because at some point it had become mine. Just as this earlier time, with its party line telephones and cheap gas, had become mine. At that moment, I cared more about Of Mice and Men than I did about Lee Harvey Oswald. But I cared even more about Mike. I took his hand off his mouth, put it on one huge thigh, put my hands on his shoulders, looked into his eyes. "Listen to me," I said. "Are you listening?"
"Yes, sir."
"You are not going to fuck up. Say it." Say it.
"I'm not going to fuck up."
"What you're going to do is amaze them. I promise you that, Mike." Gripping his shoulders tighter, it was like trying to sink my fingers into stones. He could have picked me up and broken me over his knee, but he only sat there looking at me from a pair of eyes that were humble, hopeful, and still rimmed with tears. "Do you hear me? I promise." The stage was a beachhead of light. Beyond it was a lake of darkness where the audience sat. George and Lenny stood on the bank of an imaginary river. The other men had been sent away, but they wouldn't be gone long. If the big, vaguely smiling hulk of a man in the overalls were to die with any dignity, George would have to see to it himself.
"George, where are them guys going?"
Mimi Corcoran was sitting on my right. At some point, she had taken my hand and was gripping it hard, hard, hard. We were in the first row. Next to her, on her other side, Deke Simmons was staring up at the stage with his mouth slightly hung open. It was the expression of a farmer who sees a dinosaur cropping grass in his North 40.
"Hunting. They're going hunting. Sit down, Lenny."
Vince Knowles was never going to be an actor. What he was going to be most likely was a salesman at Jody Chrysler Dodge, like his father. But a great performance can lift all the actors in a production. And that had happened tonight. Vince, who in rehearsals had only once or twice achieved even low levels of believability, mostly because his ratty, intelligent little face was Steinbeck's George Milton, had caught something from Mike. All at once, about halfway through Act One, he finally seemed to realize what it meant to go rambling through life with a Lenny as your only friend, and he'd fallen into the part. Now, watching him push an old felt hat from props back on his head, I thought that Vince looked like Henry Fonda in The Grapes of Wrath.
"George?"
"Yeah?"
"Ain't you gonna give me hell?"
"What do you mean?"
"You know George."
Smiling, the kind of smile that says, "Yeah, I know I'm a dope, but we both know I can't help it." Sitting down beside George on the imaginary riverbank, taking off his own hat, tossing it aside, rumpling his short blonde hair, imitating George's voice. Mike had nailed this with eerie ease in the very first rehearsal, with no help from me.
"If I was alone, I could live so easy. I could get a job and not have no more mess."
Then resuming his own voice, or Lenny's, rather.
"I can go away. I can go right up in the hills and find a cave, if you don't want me."
Vince Knowles lowered his head, and when he raised it and spoke his next line, his voice was thick and hitching. It was a simulacrum of sorrow he'd never approached in even his best rehearsals.
"No, Lenny, I want you to stay here with me."
"Then tell me like you done before, about other guys, and about us."
That was when I heard the first low sob from the audience. It was followed by another, and then a third. This I had not expected, not in my wildest dreams. A chill raced up my back, and I stole a glance at Mimi. She wasn't crying yet, but the liquid sheen in her eyes told me that she soon would be. Yes, even her hard old baby that she was. George hesitated, then took hold of Lenny's hand, a thing Vince never would have done in rehearsals. "That's queer boy stuff," he would have said.
"Guys like us, Lenny, guys like us got no families. They got nobody that gives a hoot in hell about them."
Touching the prop gun hidden under his coat with his other hand, taking it partway out, putting it back, then stealing himself and taking it all the way out, laying it along his leg.
"But not us, George. Not us. Isn't that right?"
Mike was gone. The stage was gone. Now it was only the two of them, and by the time Lenny was asking George to tell him about the little ranch and the rabbits and living off the fat of the land, half the audience was weeping audibly. Vince was crying so hard he could hardly deliver his final lines, telling poor, stupid Lenny to look over there. The ranch they were going to live on was over there. If he looked hard enough, he could see it. The stage lens slowly to full dark. Cindy McComas for once running the lights perfectly. Bertie Jameson, the school janitor, fired a blank cartridge. Some woman in the audience gave a little scream. That sort of reaction is usually followed by nervous laughter, but tonight there was only the sound of people weeping in their seats. Otherwise, silence. It went on for 10 seconds. Or maybe it was only 5. Whatever it was, to me, it seemed forever. Then the applause broke. It was the best thunder I ever heard in my life. The house lights went up. The entire audience was on its feet. The front 2 rows were reserved for faculty. And I happened to glance at Coach Borman. Damned if he wasn't crying, too. 2 rows back, where all the school jocks were sitting together, Jim Ledoux leaped to his feet. "You rock, Coslaw!" he shouted. This elicited cheers and laughter. The cast came out to take their bows. First the football player townspeople, then Curly and Curly's wife, then Candy and Slim and the rest of the farmhands. The applause started to die a little, and then Vince came out, flushed and happy, his own cheeks still wet. Mike Coslaw came last, shuffling as if embarrassed, then looking out in comical amazement as Mimi shouted, "Bravo!" Others echoed it, and soon the auditorium resounded with it. "Bravo! Bravo! Bravo!" Mike bowed, sweeping his hat so low it brushed the stage. When he stood again, he was smiling, but it was more than a smile. His face was transformed with the happiness that's reserved for those who are finally allowed to reach all the way up. Then he shouted, "Mr. Amberson! Come up here, Mr. Amberson!" The cast took up the chant of, "Director! Director!"
"Don't kill the applause," Mimi growled from beside me. "Get up there, you goofball!"
So I did. And the applause swelled again. Mike grabbed me, hugged me, lifted me off my feet, then set me down and gave me a hearty smack on the cheek. Everyone laughed, including me. We all grabbed hands, lifted them to the audience, and bowed. As I listened to the applause, a thought occurred to me, one that darkened my heart. In Minsk, there were newlyweds. Lee and Marina had been man and wife for exactly 19 days. 3 weeks later, just before school let out for the summer, I went to Dallas to take some photographs of the 3 apartments where Lee and Marina would live together. I used a small Minox, holding it in the palm of my hand and allowing the lens to peep out between 2 spread fingers. I felt ridiculous, more like the trench-coated caricatures in Mad Magazine's Spy versus Spy feature than James Bond. But I had learned to be careful about such things. When I returned to my house, Mimi Corcoran's sky-blue Nash Rambler was parked at the curb, and Mimi was just sliding in behind the wheel. When she saw me, she got out again. A brief grimace tightened her face. Pain or effort. But when she came up the drive, she was wearing her usual dry smile, as if I amused her, but in a good way.
In her hand, she was carrying a bulky manila envelope which contained the 150 pages of The Murder Place. I'd finally given in to her pesterings. But that had been only the day before. "Either you liked it one hell of a lot or you never got past page 10, I said, taking the envelope. "Which was it?" Her smile now looked enigmatic as well as amused. "Like most librarians, I'm a fast reader. Can we go inside and talk about it? It isn't even the middle of June, and it's already so hot." Yes, and she was sweating, something I'd never seen before. Also, she looked as if she'd lost weight. Not a good thing for a lady who had no pounds to give away. Sitting in my living room with big glasses of iced coffee, me in the easy chair, she on the couch, Mimi gave her opinion. "I enjoyed the stuff about the killer dressed up as a clown. Call me twisted, but I found that deliciously creepy." "If you're twisted, I am too," she smiled. "I'm sure you'll find a publisher for it. On the whole, I liked it very much." I felt a little hurt. The Murder Place might have begun as camouflage, but it had become more important to me as I got deeper into it. It was like a secret memoir. One of the nerves. "That on the whole stuff reminds me of Alexander Pope, you know, damning with faint praise." "I didn't quite mean it that way." More qualification. "It's just that, God damn it, George, this isn't what you were meant to do. You were meant to teach. And if you publish a book like this, no school department in the United States will hire you." She paused. "Except maybe in Massachusetts." I didn't reply. I was speechless. "What you did with Mike Coslaw, what you did for Mike Coslaw, was the most amazing and wonderful thing I've ever seen." "Mimi, it wasn't me. He's just naturally talented." "I know he's naturally talented. That was obvious from the moment he walked on stage and opened his mouth. But I'll tell you something, my friend. Something 40 years in high schools and 60 years of living has taught me, and taught me well. Artistic talent is far more common than the talent to nurture artistic talent. Any parent with a hard hand can crush it, but to nurture it is much more difficult. That's a talent you have, and in much greater supply than the one that drove this." She tapped the sheaf of pages on the coffee table in front of her. I don't know what to say. "Say thank you and compliment me on my acute judgment." "Thanks. And your insight is only exceeded by your good looks." That brought the smile back, drier than ever. "Don't exceed your brief, George." "Yes, Miss Mimi." The smile disappeared. She leaned forward. The blue eyes behind her glasses were too big, swimming in her face. The skin under her tan was yellowish, and her formerly taut cheeks were hollow. When had this happened? Had Deke noticed? But this was ridic, as the kid said. Deke wouldn't notice that his socks were mismatched until he took them off at night. Probably not even then. She said, "Phil Bateman is no longer just threatening to retire. He's done pulled the pin and tossed the grenade, as our delightful Coach Borman would say. Which means there's a vacancy on the English faculty. Come and teach full-time at DCHS, George. The kids like you. And after the junior-senior play, the community thinks you're the second coming of Alfred Hitchcock. Deke is just waiting to see your application. He told me so just last night. Please, publish this under a pseudonym if you have to, but come and teach. That's what you were meant to do." I wanted badly to say yes, because she was right. My job wasn't writing books, and it certainly wasn't killing people, no matter how much they deserved killing. And there was Jody. I'd come to it as a stranger who'd been displaced from his home era as well as his hometown. And the first words spoken to me here by Al Stevens at the diner had been friendly words. If you've ever been homesick or felt exiled from all the things and people that once defined you, you'll know how important welcoming words and friendly smiles can be. Jody was the anti-Dallas, and now one of its leading citizens was asking me to be a resident instead of a visitor. But the watershed moment was approaching. Only it wasn't here yet.
Maybe. George, you have the most peculiar look on your face. That's called thinking. Will you let me do it, please? She put her hands to her cheeks and rounded her mouth in a comic oh of apology. Well, braid my hair and call me Buckwheat. I paid no attention because I was busy flicking through Al's notes. I no longer had